I'm Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 5, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Jonathan, and this is episode 96, discussing Bookshops and Bone Dust by Travis Baldry, which is the prequel to his cozy fantasy debut, Legends and Lattes.
I'm former practically permanent guest host, now finally an actual host, Seth, here to inform you that this episode will feature all the spoilers for both Bookshops and Bone Dust and Legends and Lattes. Oh, and that the opinions are those of us as individuals and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole, though, let's be real, we're usually all on the same page or very close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon with 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month, which I keep saying I will update and then not finding time to do so. It offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment. And now it's time for us to join back up with Viv the Orc and some of her friends. Though a somewhat different version of Viv, surrounded by a mostly different cast of characters than her buddies in Legends and Lattes.
Because when we first met Viv in Legends and Lattes, she was ready to hang up her sword and settle down. But Bookshops and Bone Dust begins with her reveling in a battle against the skeletal troops of someone called Vereen the Pale. You see, this younger and less world-weary Viv is a member of a party called Rackham's Ravens, or at least she is until she is badly injured in the battle and Rackham sends her to the nearby seaside town of Merc to convalesce. Viv doesn't remember much about the trip or her arrival, and when she is finally lucid again, she finds herself housed in the Perch, an inn run by a sea fae named Brand. After scarfing down a much-needed hearty meal, she heads out to explore the town, but unfortunately there isn't much to see. Essentially just a lot of closed storefronts, a seedy-looking bookshop, and a delicious-smelling bakery. She does run into a couple of locals, Pitts, an old orc who informs her that she almost strangled the town surgeon, and a Tepente gate warden who clearly doesn't look too kindly on Viv's presence in her town. The encounter leaves Viv even more frustrated with her current situation, so instead of making this long trek all the way back to her lonely room at the inn, she deigns to stop in at the bookshop, where she is almost immediately set upon by a griffet. This part pug dog, part owl is named Pot Roast, and much like the aforementioned gate warden, he does not care for Viv. The shop owner apologizes and waves off a mess Viv made by knocking over a stack of books, and despite being more extroverted and foul-mouthed than any ratkin Viv has previously encountered, she is far more polite than her pet, introducing herself as Fern and even offering Viv a book on credit. Granted, Viv wasn't exactly planning on buying a book in the first place, but she had just broken a plank in front of the store and then made a mess inside of it, so she takes the preferred novel back to the inn and ends up so engrossed that she finishes it the very next day. Unfortunately, this happens just in time for the surgeon, Hylark, to pay her a visit, and when she complains about being cooped up, he offers something that, while supremely painful at first, has by the next day left her healed up enough to at least be more mobile than before. Oh, and after sleeping late, she is starving. When she wakes up, which means a trip to the local bakery is in order, she loads up on freshly baked buns and flirtuous behavior with the proprietor, a dwarf named Mei Li, and brings these goodies to the bookshop as an apology for not returning sooner. Fern presses another book on Viv before she leaves, but soon enough, reading isn't the only thing Viv has in mind, because she wants to fix the boardwalk plank that she broke, and when she stops Pitts to ask about supplies, he agrees to meet her the following day.
But before that can come to fruition, and while Viv is trying to settle down with this new book, who wanders into the inn but knife-obsessed gnome Galena? Yes, that Galena from Legends and Lattes. Viv wants nothing more than to brush her off, but Galena is, very insistent. She wants Viv to introduce her to Rackham, but Viv makes her annoyance quite clear, and eventually Galena stops away. The next day, Fern is surprised to find Viv fixing the broken plank, and Viv is surprised when Pitts insists she doesn't owe him anything for the supplies to do so. The three of them share a pleasant lunch. Pitts walks away with a book of poetry, and when Fern asks what Viv would change about the shop, she mentions the smell in the carpet, but any additional fixes will have to wait for another day, because next Viv visits Hylark and exchanges her crutches for a walking staff. And while she might not be totally healed up, she's feeling pretty good, until she catches sight of someone who makes her skin crawl. A very pale man in a gray cloak, it stood drawn up to hide most of his face. She soon loses track of him, and a stop at Maylee's bakery does a lot to help her forget her anxious mood, as do the ensuing days in which Viv helps Fern tidy up the bookshop, reading the books her new friends suggest to her, and trying to avoid Galena, and eventually getting to know Maylee better. Unfortunately, it's not all good times, especially when creepy gray cloak dude pops into the bookshop and actually hits Pot Roast. How dare! Viv follows him, and of course they get into an altercation, with Galena lending a hand, until, that is, they're caught by the Tepenti Gate Warden, Iridia, and all three thrown in jail. Well, until the creepy stranger disappears from his jail, that is. At first, Iridia doesn't seem keen on releasing Viv and Galena, but they don't know much more than she does about the man they were fighting. Other than Viv thinking he smelled like a white, which Iridia side-eyes because dude apparently still had a pulse. Anyway, soon enough, Viv and Galena are sent on their way, perhaps not fast friends, but certainly friendlier. Viv's relationship with Maylee, on the other hand, progresses quite a bit more, as do her and Fern's plans for the bookshop. But then the creepy stranger comes back into the picture, only not in the way any of them expected, because he's dead, y'all. Just straight up, totally, and completely dead. Of course, Iridia catches them near the body, but even after Viv points out that the man has Varine's mark, the Gate Warden orders her and Galena to stay out of the whole situation. Unfortunately for Iridia, they had already taken and hidden the man's satchel, but when they eventually recover it and bring it to the bookshop, they discover it's just filled with bones? But wait, there's more. A bottle of bone dust. Which leads to Fern pulling out a giant old book and informing them that the dust will reanimate the bones into something called a homunculus. Obviously, they decide to see what's what, and after sprinkling the bones with some of the dust, they gather into a full-on skeleton that announces, "I exist to serve." Now, technically, the homunculus belongs to the lady, aka Varine, but apparently he also has to serve anyone who wakes him. He tells Viv and friends that the lady calls him Satchel, and that the creepy guy, who is apparently called Balthus, stole him from her. Also, despite having to serve whoever wakes him, Satchel also has to keep the lady's secrets. But even if he can't spill the deets on his true master, Satchel becomes a helpful, if through no real choice of his own, member of their little bookshop crew.
In fact, it's by talking with Satchel that Fern decides to have a boardwalk sale. And in the midst of their preparations, they discover why Balthus was in the bookshop in the first place, to hide the tome of a book that he'd stolen from Varine along with Satchel. The book is filled with inky black pages, but of course it's not just any book, and they aren't just any pages. With a couple of quick tests, Viv learns that things can be, shall we say, inserted into the pages and pulled back out again without any visible harm having been done. Well, not right away, at least, though Satchel does admit that no living thing can survive long in what he calls the underspace, a sort of treasure vault, but not everything contained is a treasure. Granted, Viv does pull out a really cool greatsword, but after that, she decides the safest place for the book is with Iridia, especially considering the book essentially calls to Varine anytime something is removed from it. Yeah, so cool sword, but bit of an oopsies in first pulling it from the book and then keeping it, Viv. After ridding themselves of Varine's nasty book, it's about time for the boardwalk book sale, which actually goes pretty well, but this also means that any demand for reading material that existed in Merc has been satisfied. And this just before Fern is about to receive a shipment of new books. Still, they continue their general shop improvements, and Viv continues her mostly sweet but sometimes awkward relationship with Maylee. Everything is as it should be. Well, until Viv starts dreaming about Varine, that is. This leads to her having a bit of a heart-to-heart with Satchel, and while not all of their conversation is revealed just yet, it sounds as if he is about to, well, kind of break some of his rules surrounding the lady and give Viv some intel on how she might be killed. But while they wait for Varine's seemingly inevitable arrival, they meet a local author and convince her to do a reading at Fern's shop, and Viv even takes Galena and Satchel on a mini mission to take out some monsters that have been harassing a local farm. Unfortunately, it's during their brief time away that Varine's forces show up in Merc, leaving Viv and Satchel to fight their way through to retrieve Varine's book from Iridia. Varine herself is, of course, holed up at the bookshop with Fern and Galena as her prisoners. She demands that her book be returned, and Viv obliges, but only because Satchel is hidden inside of it, waiting to pull Vereen in and trap her inside. They almost lose Pot Roast in the process, but in the end, the Griffa is pulled to safety after helping to relieve them of their enemy, and Satchel is even safe as well. Viv then stabs the book with the greatsword she got from it, a sword which, by the way, she had since learned was called Black Blood, and that's the end of Vereen the Pale, and nearly the end of this part of Viv's tale. She does have a bittersweet parting of the ways with Mei Li, says goodbye to Satchel, Pot Roast, and Fern, and then meets back up with Rackham to presumably continue those adventures, but with Galena in tow, so yay for that. And hey, at the very end of it all, we circle back to Viv's coffee shop in Thune, where she receives a letter from Fern, who will be visiting that city soon, and possibly staying longer than just a little while to boot. After all, what better neighbor is there for a coffee shop than a bookstore? Wink, wink. I kept trying to make that summary shorter and not doing it.
For a short, cozy book, there's a fair amount that happens.
Anyway, I thought there were quite a few, not quite a few, but there's definitely several parallels and connections between Bookshops and Bone Dust and Legends and Lattes. I mean, it is a prequel to the previous book we talked about. First being that Mei Li herself used to be a fighter and now runs a successful bakery. So literally Viv.
Yeah, what happens with Viv.
There's also lots of talk about how Mei Li still has her mace. It's just hung up. And then also Viv helps Fern fix up her bookshop. So in this case, it's switched, right?
Yeah.
Fern is the local with a shop that needs fixing. Viv is the traveler helping fix it up. But it's the same basic storyline, essentially.
Yeah.
In that small respect. I'm not saying it's the same overall, obviously. But now one thing I wanted to ask you is, did you guys also feel, because I think this one is a little bit more tentative, that there was maybe a connection in that Zelia Greatstrider, the reclusive author, older woman, by the way, author, is a little bit similar to the Madrigal, maybe like mysterious older local woman, both intimidating in their own ways, both help out in the end, Zelia by having her reading at Fern's bookshop and the Madrigal by going easy on Viv and then even helping her rebuild her coffee shop. I think it's a little bit of a tentative connection, but yeah. I don't know, you guys think there's enough there?
I just think they serve different narrative functions.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I would look for in it, to establish a parallel, but that's, mm-hmm. I mean, the result of some education I had.
Oh, no. And let me be very clear. I wouldn't call this a parallel. It's more just like a very similar character type.
I could definitely see the character type being in the same ballpark.
Again, just mysterious older woman that's also kind of a recluse. But yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
I didn't think they were similar at all. I thought of one as essentially a mob boss and the other as just a romance writer living out in the wilds, similar to, I can't remember what the name of the woman who lives basically in Boonesboro, Maryland is, who's the famous Nora Roberts, I think her name is.
Oh, Nora Roberts lives in Maryland? I didn't know that.
Yeah, she lives out in Boonesboro.
Yeah, she's also a noble, isn't she, or is she just rich?
She's 1,000 years old. So,
okay, yeah.
And I love that line. It's like, you can't make a fortune in 1,000 years. You're either a monk or you're just an idiot.
I mean, and this is why I wanted to ask you this, because I already know the connection is tentative, right?
Yeah.
And for me, it was just the idea of this like mysterious older local woman. Again, like I said, like both intimidating in their own ways and both do a little something to help out. It's more so for Viv on the Madrigal's part, whereas on Zelia's, it's really more so for Fern. But because of Viv. So again, like I said, I know this is a tentative connection and I know they do not serve the same narrative purpose by any means. To me, I felt it was like a similar enough character where obviously not a copy, obviously, but at least I could see that kind of, I can make this connection between these two characters, which you can't do with all of them in both books. But, you know, for instance, we've also got Pot Roast the Griffet and Amity the Giant Cat that are shop pets, essentially. So.
Well, yes, but I believe we all know, and this wouldn't happen because they're both cinnamon rolls and must be protected at all costs. I believe we all know that Amity would eat Pot Roast for breakfast.
Probably.
Moros theoretically fly away.
I don't think his wings are well developed enough for that, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. And the pictures of him don't really, it's his head that's more owlish than anything.
Yeah, he looks like an owl dog, like an owl bear, but with a dog.
An owl dog bear with a dog?
Well, you know, It's like an owlbear, except with a dog.
An owl dog. The last thing, obviously, this is not the most important part of the story as a whole, but Bookshops and Bone Dust is the tale of how Viv got Black Blood. Obviously, she doesn't use the sword in Legends and Lattes, but it is a prevalent part of that story because the whole story is about her hanging up her sword and not wanting to have to take it down again.
The name of the sword just reminds me of the Blue Oyster Cult song Black Blade, which is, of course, about Elric of Melniboné's Stormbringer.
But that is a cursed sword, and it was questionable. Fern was warning her that this might be a cursed sword.
I felt that Black Blood did have a mild to moderate My Precious effect.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem to be overly harmful. It was just this is neat and I want to keep it. It's mine now.
It did play a part in Viv having those dreams.
Oh, definitely. Because it was
so.
Yeah.
Would you call that like a curse?
I think that is actually just Vereen's own magic doing a find thing.
Yeah.
Somebody's using one of my things. Where are they?
Any other thoughts on parallels or connections that you guys had?
Well, I mean, there were two rats.
On very different ends of the spectrum, apparently. There's also there's a baker in the story, like a very talented baker. Symbol.
There can be multiple talented bakers. I'm all
for sure. No, I am too. Bakers. But I do think that is a bit of a theme. He really does love writing about pastries. Well, Travis Baldry.
Yeah. I mean, I also think it's part of the coziness of it. How are you going to get a good cozy? There's a relationship between fantasy and food that I'm not going to go into, but I will say it's there enough that I could have written papers about it. So for a cozy, the idea of having this wonderful store full of comfort food seems to really be appropriate to the genre.
Well, we touched on Vereen a little bit when we were talking about Black Blood a minute ago. So thoughts on the bad guys? And obviously we're talking about Balthus, who isn't around for long at all, and Vereen, who is very quickly and soundly defeated. Now, I just want to say, at the same time, the big bads and the fights with them are not what this genre is about, as far as I can tell from what little I've read of cozy fantasy. So it's hard to, I'm not going to hate on how quickly both of these bad guys come and go.
What about the bad guy who stabbed her in the beginning of the book?
They were part of Vereen's army.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't call that's not a specific bad guy. That's just part of the Vereen experience, I guess.
The Vereen experience.
Now that said, fuck Balthus for smacking pot roast. Mm. Honestly. Never, no. And then also fuck Vereen a lot for Wave's hands, everything to do with poor Satchel. But what are your guys' thoughts on these bad guys? I felt like Balthus was almost made out to be a little bit too important considering how quickly he came and went. But other than
catalyzed a lot of the later action though.
Yeah. I just feel like it was how many encounters did Viv really need to have with him? And then he just dies and there's no explanation of how. You'd think that if it was one of Vereen's people who came and found and killed him, why didn't they start sacking the town for the book or take the satchel that contains Satchel? I don't know.
Yeah.
That was a little bit weird to me, but.
Well, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I also yes, Vereen is terrible for having done what she did to Satchel. But on the other hand, I'm happy Satchel was there. I like him. I just had this thought about Vereen, literally just now, and I don't think anybody is going to do it in a cozy novel, but in a cozy fantasy short story, especially given the baking idea that we're going with, I would love to see the denouement of one of these things be not unlike the old Holstice fruit pie ads on the back of the Marvel comics. Where the bad guy's menacing and the good guy's but take a bite of this, and the bad guy's well, I don't know. A delicious cinnamon bun. Oh, you've captured me, but I can't complain.
The Snickers ads that were big for a while
were
that too, where somebody's just in a real bad mood, but they're just hangry and they need a Snickers. And I will say this, Vereen is definitely more of a big bad in terms of the world as a whole than Fennis was in Legends and Lattes. That's probably the only thing I would have to say about how quickly and soundly she was defeated is that everybody knows about her and everybody knows she's bad. And Rackham, him and his party have been hired to try to fight her and take her out and they're having trouble with it. And so it's in that case, it's a little bit convenient that she meets her end this way. I'm not like really complaining. It is nice to just have like a cleanly wrapped up, we don't ever have to deal with this bitch again situation. But
I mean, she's very much hoist by her own petard. Very much.
Very true. That feels great, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like everything that ends up leading to her demise is one of her tools. And I'm sorry to put Satchel in that category, but
that's how she used him.
That's how she
viewed and used him. So yeah.
Did you guys think the villains were missing motivations?
No, I mean, Balthus had enough of one. He was trying to become powerful on his own. And I don't think that anyone who's a necromancer calling themselves the Pale needs a motivation. They're over in the corner cackling and rubbing their hands. And if they're mask presenting, twiddling their mustache. And just be like, oh, the world. You're like, okay, yeah, sure. I got your number. It's fine.
It's not wrong to want a villain to have motivations. I do think Balthus, his motivations were probably more clear than Vereen's. But yeah, I think that Vereen being what she was, I think her motivation was to like rule the world, or at least this section of it, possibly spread out from there. But to be honest, I did read this book about 7 or 8 months ago, so I don't remember if they really spelled out what her motivation might be. But I think some of that is also, it's kind of like when you look at some of the simpler YA novels, the big bad, their motivation is to always just to rule the world. With this, especially with this sort of genre, I don't know that there needs to be like some sort of listed, deep-seated motivation. I think it's just clear that Vereen wants to wreak some havoc and gather some treasures and just be a dick to people.
Yeah, I mean, if you need motivation, you could just take a look at the most recent well-known pop culture necromancer, who is, of course, Zaz Tam, lately from the D&D movie. And what's his motivation? Well, it's the accumulation of more power. I'm going to take over a whole town and turn him into undead. So now I've got another whole town under my control. Look at me. I'm a bad necromancer. Ooh.
I would have said Anita Blake, Vampire Hunter, myself.
But... Hey, she doesn't have a movie.
No, she doesn't.
Old Zaz Tam's got a movie.
But she has like 40 books.
Yes. But is she more famous for necromancy or banging all the people in her books? And I think the answer is B.
I think that series of books was actually written by Zelia Greatstrider.
On a more positive note, gotta ask you guys, not counting Viv, who was your favorite bookshop character? Let me just say this. To be honest, I feel like this is really just Fern, Potroast, and Satchel. Galena only ends up in the bookshop because of Viv, and she got to be part of our favorites pick list in our Legends and Lattes episode anyway. So we're leaving Galena out. So the three choices.
No Balthus then.
No.
No. I mean, he steps into the bookshop once. But so yeah, out of those three, Fern, the foul-mouthed ratkin proprietor who is great at giving book recs, Potroast, the adorable, somewhat overprotective Hootie Griffith, or Satchel, the helpful homunculus who really comes into his own by the end.
Okay, so here's my problem. I like all of them.
Same. Like, oh, yeah.
Fern is great. Do I love the fact that Travis Baldry said, okay, why don't you do the blind book date thing? Yes, I do. I love that that's what they were doing for the boardwalk sale. Now, Potroast. Well, okay, I think we've established, perhaps not on this podcast, but it's been established elsewhere, that I'm like Elmira when it comes to cute animals. If you don't know who Elmira is, look her up. She's from Tiny Toons. But do I want a Griffith? Yes, I do. I want to hold him and squeeze him and possibly name him George, but I really want a Griffith. Now, Satchel.
Such a great fucking 90s reference. I love it.
I can't help it. I'm like, I have such cute aggression all the time. I have cute aggression with one of my cats that we've had for like 8 years now. I can't help it. Anyway, and Satchel, here's the thing though, is I really relate to that guy. You're just some weirdo who comes out and knows things? Yeah, okay, I'm right there with you, man. But I think given my prejudices, I'm just going to have to go with Potroast because I love Potroast and I want to pet him.
I'm a Fern fan. I mean, I guess I'm a sucker for rat characters.
But that's the thing. Like Seth said, they're all freaking great. This one is really, really hard for me, honestly, because I love Fern. First of all, I love that she can't get rid of books. She's like, I can't just get rid of these books. I'm not throwing away these disgusting, musty old books. I'll sell them somehow, maybe, but I'm not getting rid of them. God. I also love that she's really great at giving book recommendations. And pot roast, I'm with you, Seth. I not just cute, adorable animals, but all animal characters are just immediately like, I want to hold you and rock you and cozy you and make you my best friend, even if you don't want to be.
Yes.
But I think pot roast, he loses a couple points with me only because he like just hates Viv until the very end. And all Viv did was knock over some books. And I suppose this is a different Viv than the one we meet in Legends and Lattes, right? This is 20 years prior. She's a different person. I mean, honestly, me 20 years ago was a totally different person. So yeah. I get it. But I think I got to go with Satchel. He's sad and amusing. He has a sad story. And I don't think he means to be as clever and amusing as he is, but he is.
Yeah.
He helps with the idea with the Boardwalk book sale, and he breaks the rules that have been embedded into him by fear and trauma to help the characters that are good characters who have been trying to help him overcome these things. It's like Pot Roast a little bit over Fern and Satchel a little bit over Pot Roast, but I'm going to go with Satchel.
Here's a game that I know that as a fan of fantasy, I've played in the past, both on my own with other people, and it's which fantasy world would you live in if you could? And being me, I usually default to Middle Earth but would I like to live in Travis Baldry's? You could not get me out of Fern's bookshop. I would end up working there.
Seriously, it would either be me hanging out in Viv's coffee shop writing.
Yeah.
Or yeah, hanging out in the bookshop just because it's such a cozy. The only thing they could do to drive me to that bookshop more would be to add like a wine bar. Or like local brewery tastings or something. Continuing on.
Funny you should mention, in Ocean City, Maryland, there is a bookshop with a wine bar.
There used to be one in Greenville. I'm not sure if it's still there because things in Greenville have been flipped a lot in the past like 7 or 8 years because growing small city, pricing out their longtime residents, et cetera. But this was probably less gentrification and more just like, we're this up and coming city that gets featured in all these magazines and on all these travel websites and stuff. And so now we can charge twice the rent for your downtown spot. There is very much a theme in this, and even really in Legends and Lattes, but I think more so in this book of like the local shop owner. And in this book, it's more so because it's like more so with Fern, especially that idea of like the local bookshop, you know, even though there's no Barnes and Noble coming in to take over her space, it's still, you feel that like undertone there. Now, all that said, continuing on kind of the same tack, favorite Merc resident outside of the bookshop, the poetry spouting orc named Pitts, reclusive local author Zelia Greatstrider, avid reader Highlark, elf surgeon with a maybe not so great bedside manner, Brand the Seafay tavern keeper, even if he's always cleaning out that one same mug, lol, gross, pissy but also proactive gate warden Iridia, or the brawler turned baker dwarf Maylee.
This is an easy one for me. Hands down, Maylee.
Not surprised. I'm just going to say I like Maylee. I'm actually going to go with Pitts.
He's strong. Yeah. I like Pitts. I just...
You don't expect him to be a poet. And he also, when Viv wants to repair the boardwalk, he brings her all the supplies and doesn't charge her for him. He just seems like a cool dude. But yeah, I figured Maylee would be the popular choice. I don't know, though, Jonathan, what about you?
I think now that I think about this a little more, it will be Zelia Greatstrider, because I just realized the way she became wealthy was basically writing smut and being the smut peddler for 1,000 years. So
respect for that.
Yeah,
respect.
Yeah, exactly. That's,
but on a more serious note, I actually liked the surgeon. I thought he was a lot of fun.
It was funny because it's like
he had a little attitude.
Actually, I am surprised. Like, I figured I would be the only one who didn't choose Maylee. To be fair, she is the most prevalent of the town characters, with, I would say, like the other character who has almost as much page time is Iridia. And Iridia is maddening at times, but also very clearly good at her job. All she wants is to protect her town. And she doesn't always necessarily go about it the right way. You know, her attitude against Viv in the beginning isn't great, but she is very good at what she does. And she's not, it's not like a hashtag not all cops situation here. But yeah, I thought there would be more Maylees. I wish that we had Nick here. I would put Nick as either Maylee or Zelia Greatstrider. I feel like he would super respect the smutty fanfic author. Anyway, I did expect it to be Mei Li. Therefore, the next question focuses on her bakery, as in, what would you be most likely to order from the Seasong Bakery? We've got some bread, crusty loaves, salted rounds, et cetera, et cetera. Big flaky biscuits, sugar-studded buns. And now I will say this. I'm not sure if the sugar-studded buns and the ginger lassi buns are the same thing. But just in case they aren't, there were sugar-studded buns. And then there are ginger lassi buns, a.k.a. molasses buns, which usually have raisins, scones, just scones in general. So I'm assuming there's more than one type. But maybe not. Maybe they're all raisin. Blech. And then the last thing was long sticky cakes. And I honestly do not know for sure what these are. I Googled it. And the things that came up is one of two things. Sticky toffee pudding cake, which yum. But the other thing that was coming up was Swedish sticky chocolate cake. And because lassi buns are actually more of a Norwegian thing, maybe the sticky cakes are actually Swedish sticky chocolate cake. I don't know. Do you guys have any idea of what the sticky cakes might be other than those two things?
No.
I mean, honestly, given that it's a fantasy setting, I mean, I know we're waving some things here because coffee and everyone. I was thinking like some sort of honey cakes. I was not, and I want to state this for the record, thinking lemon cakes. But other people, whose names I won't mention, might have been having read that description.
The sticky cakes were wrapped in lemon-scented paper?
Lemon-scented paper, that, to me, argues a little bit more...
Honey, probably.
Honey, because both a sticky toffee and a sticky chocolate, I would imagine, I haven't had it, but I've had enough chocolate cake to, you know, it's chocolate cake. Lemon's not going to go with those flavor
profiles. Yeah.
No, like, sticky toffee pudding, maybe like a little lemon zest somewhere, but I think even that's going to screw it up. So.
Yeah, no, I agree. Chocolate, maybe, but I don't know. Yeah. So anyway, sticky cakes or ginger lassi buns, which are molasses. They're ginger molasses buns with ginger in them. That's kind of a normal thing. Or breads, biscuits. What would be your choice?
Yes.
I know you had to choose one, just like Thimble's.
No, I refuse. No. I'm not choosing a baked good.
You have to. I insist.
All right. I can honestly see myself going in there and buying like one of each and then... Which is dumb to do with baked goods. You want to eat those fresh. You kind of, scones, yeah. Okay, yeah. But you kind of want to eat the rest of them same day, you know? But, oh, gosh, I mean, I have such a sweet tooth. I'm going to go with the sticky cakes. But I guarantee you, I would have been, if I lived in that town and there was as little to do as is described, mm-hmm. I would have gone through her entire inventory at some point.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
What about you, Jonathan?
I guess the second one, the ginger lassi bun, but none of these really... I'm much more a cake person or a cookie person, so none of these really floats my boat.
Yeah, so my problem is, like, I'm not a biscuit person.
But wait a minute. Aren't you going to move to the South?
I did not grow up in the South. Okay. And yes, I did. I lived in the South. I mean, I went to college in the South and I lived in the South the vast majority of my adult life. But I'm not a big, like, I will say, like, the really, like, pull apart biscuits that you can get, those are a little bit more like my style. But like just a biscuit, I don't know. I feel like the food in this one just did not appeal to me as much as the food in Legends and Lattes of this list. Not really knowing what sticky cakes are, but assuming they might be honey cakes and having had those are fine. And I like scones, but I'm very particular about scones.
Yeah. And I mean, so, it's like, what are you looking to do with the scone? Is it a plain scone? Or are we putting cream and jam on it?
Right. Oh,
I hope Mei Li does a high tea. Anyway, moving on.
Seriously, though, yeah. Right? But because of just, I'm going to go with the ginger lassi buns and just hope they're the ones, that they're the Norwegian version that doesn't usually have raisins in them. I think at one point there's like a comment about how there is some like fruit or something involved with them, which, ugh. But my grandmother made a lot of molasses things growing up. So to me, that just, the thought of it brings me back to my childhood. Anyway, so much talk about food. So speaking of the bakery and therefore Mei Li, how do we feel about Viv's little summer romance? And I'm going to let you guys go first because I have like thoughts on this, but I want to hear what you guys think.
I mean, I thought, wasn't she a little old for her? Maybe it's not as bad because, you know, I consider a retired fighter. So I think, okay, retired fighter, she's probably over 40.
Viv is like 30.
I'm just putting him in our lifespan terms, and I just thought she was a little bit older, and I thought that was, you know.
Well, I think as a dwarf, even a relatively young one, you're probably going to be a little bit older than most of the people you find.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But then we shouldn't even get to the Zelia's romance with her younger friend.
I was also informed on a podcast by a lesbian that apparently lesbians love an age gap, so I don't know. Make of that what you
isn't know. That sort of stereotypical?
Hey, that's what she said. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I would call that a stereotype. Granted, I am not a lesbian, but having dated several women in my time, I always stuck within like a few years of my own age. I would feel weird dating someone more than like 3 or 4 years younger than me, honestly.
Again, we don't know how old Mei Li is.
Right, because she could have quit at a much younger age too, because that's the thing. Like, some of the things she says make me think that she fought for a while and was like, this isn't for me. And she might have been over it a lot faster than Viv was.
But I mean, honestly, how do I feel about the romance? Maybe they had them a blast. You know, it was a summer romance. It happened so fast.
My God, I should have known someone was going to make a joke. Let me give my opinion and then maybe you guys can help me talk this or think this out, whatever. Personally, I'm very torn about it. I get that Viv is attracted to Mei Li, but it seems a lot more like Mei Li coming on strong and Viv kind of giving into that. And I'm not saying in a bad way. Okay. Like I'm not saying that Mei Li was doing anything wrong. Kind of the opposite. In fact, sure. Viv likes Mei Li, even likes her like that, but Viv probably shouldn't have let things go even as far as they did, because it still feels way more one-sided on Mei Li's part. Like at one point Viv is thinking about how while she's stuck in Merc, there's no harm in wringing some enjoyment out of her time there. And she tacks on the thought or a little companionship, and it says she thinks guiltily of Mei Li, which I'm very meh about. Like, I almost feel like Viv was in the wrong here. It's one thing to have like a little bit of a flirtation or whatever, but she goes on dates, they make out. Yeah, I don't know if there was more beyond that. I would assume not so much more, but there's enough that it just feels like Mei Li knows Viv is going to leave, but it seems like she feels more attached to Viv and more upset about the idea of Viv leaving than Viv ever is attached to or upset about the idea of leaving Mei Li. Does that make sense?
It does, but it's also two people who are just starting to date each other. And you can have that. You can have one person being more attached. I mean, we also generally have a great capacity for self-deception. And it's like, well, life's short. When I know they're leaving and that's not what I want, but maybe they won't leave. You know, there's all of that going on. So it is slightly star-crossed, but I don't think it's like inappropriate or unrealistic for at least the dating part to have happened.
I don't disagree with that. I just like, when I first read it, their relationship, for lack of a better word, it's not really like a relationship, didn't really sit right with me. And even like kind of skimming through it to write up this summary and some notes and stuff, it still just didn't sit well. And I can't really place why. And it's probably a me thing, right? Like, I do not doubt that there's a big part of a me thing going on here, where there's like some experience or experiences I've had in my past that are making me a little bit more like meh about it. And also, it could just be like reading Legends and Lattes first and the sweetness of Viv and Tandri and knowing how she ends up and feeling like this is just a weird, awkward truck stop along the way. I don't know.
Yeah, but we've all had failed relationships in our past. You know, it's like, again, I'm saying I'm not super troubled by it. They're just mismatched in what they want. And that's the way things go.
Yeah, no, troubled isn't the right word. It's just like, I don't know. There's something about it that doesn't sit right with me and I can't place it. I guess there's a part of me that's trying to feel out whether it's the way it was written or whether it really is just all me. I've had vacation romances. I've had summer romance, you know, whatever, whether it was like actually a summer or like a semester at college, whatever. I've had those romances. But in this case, I don't know. There's something about it that feels more awkward than I didn't feel it. I didn't get it, really. The flirtation, sure. Maybe hanging out, sure. but it almost felt like both of them were taking it too seriously, but in different ways. And maybe that's what throws me off. I don't know. Any thoughts, Jonathan?
Oh, not really. to me, it was just par for the course. They had a little fling. I thought it was more than just making out, but that's okay. I just assumed it was a real fling.
Oh, no, I didn't assume it was. I thought it was just kissing.
Yeah, me
did
too.
You? Okay, I thought they went further than that, but that's just my own interpretation or dirty mind, depending on how you look.
This is why you like that smut writer, Zelia Greatstrider.
Well, I'm sure I say this a lot. Jonathan, I'm sure if we headed over to AO3 and checked out the fanfic, we'd find out that you're right.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Anyway, we've gotten completely off topic again. So to bring it back around, but also in a weird sort of, you can kind of tie this into the idea of fanfic. I love how they constantly bring up or bring back the concept of moist books.
Well, I mean, I just assume those are bodice rippers, right?
I believe Viv is the first one who calls them that. And I assume she's referring to body romances. But forgive me, it's been a while since I read this book, fully read it. So there might be a double meaning, because there also might be like tears crying over relationship stuff and whatnot. But mostly sex, probably.
So, yeah. So let me go back to Anita Blake Vampire Hunter, because I love the first couple of books in that series.
Yes.
When it was, there was some sexuality to it, but for the most part, it was a cool merger between Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Spencer for Hire. And I thought they were great. And then they just devolved into not even good smutty, essentially porn. Obviously, they went there because the author could sell more books, but...
And they kept sticking them on the sci-fi and fantasy shelves, and then for the mid-90s to early 2000s, the sci-fi and fantasy shelves were full of Anita Blake imitators. You could not throw a rock without hitting a book that was about a female protagonist who investigated things and also had questionable relationships. Now, Seth, you're going to say to me, but aren't all epic fantasy books the same? And I will say, yes, I'll shut up about how they were all the same now. Anyway, but yes, I've ranted about Anita Blake before. I will say the first four are good. And then in the rest of them, everything that we've learned about Anita's character in the first four gets thrown out of the window. So she can bang people, including banging people that she says she will never bang.
Yeah. Enough of Anita Blake.
But a moist book, 50 Shades, perhaps there's an orc moist book called 50 Shades of Green. I don't know. But it's fun that in the middle of this cozy fantasy book with romance elements, they keep bringing up the idea of, in this fantasy world, there are smut books. And then here is an author of these smut books.
Well, especially Viv might be the first one who calls them that. But then when they're packaging up the books for the secret book sale, Fern, again, she mentions packaging some moist books together. And Satchel has been like put back in his bag for some reason. I can't remember why. And you hear his voice just coming from the satchel, like, moist books. And later, Viv catches Satchel reading, and it's not a moist book, I don't believe, because of the way he responds. He says it's only possible that he could see the appeal of reading, but perhaps he should sample one of the moist ones. And we also find out that Galena specifically requested a moist book. It's a funny little bit that the author keeps bringing back around that didn't need to be a bit, but I think it's a little bit extra funny because of the word moist and how much people usually like just hate that word.
Yeah.
But in this world, there's not anybody being like, ew, gross. Why are you using that word? It just keeps being brought back up. Also, I'm sorry, like Satchel from inside his little bag being like, moist books. And then later being like,
I never knew people didn't like that word.
Maybe I
should. Oh, yeah, that's been the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
Why is that?
It is a gross sounding word. I'm not one of those people who's like super anti the word moist, but it's weird to say. I don't like it. I just am not like supremely grossed out by it.
It's hard to describe good cake without it.
Yeah, moist cake.
Moist. Cake is nice and moist. The problem is,
it's a moist basement. I mean,
okay. I think
I wouldn't go with moist. I would go with damp for a
damp.
Bit.
I would go or dank perhaps. Jonathan, I think if I may, perhaps if I do this,
I'm old.
Rather than thinking of it as moist, it's a nice descriptive word that you use. Think of it as people walking around being like, moist. Like that kind of general attitude, the general salaciousness, the using it to describe a particular condition of particular body parts.
And usually it's not used like,
which until now I've never heard of.
Oh boy.
Oh yeah. And that's the thing. Usually it's not used in a great way either. Yeah. You know, like moist cake is one thing. Referring to body romances as moist is amusing in its own way, but it's got a gross connotation in the past, like, yeah, a couple decades, like a long time.
Yeah, oh yeah, people started complaining about moist for a while. I mean,
it was over 20 years ago, I think.
I want to say it was before Eddie Murphy used it in that manner in The Nutty Professor.
God, when did that movie?
A movie I never saw.
I believe that came out when I was still in college. So that was sometime between 1995 and 2000.
It was in the 90s.
Late 90s. I think you're right. Well, anyway, I still find their discussion, or maybe not discussion isn't the right word, but the insertion of like this Lowell idea of moist books, especially because like someone is always snickering about it, right?
Yeah.
But it's not because they think the word is gross. It's because like, they want the sexy shit.
Exactly.
But since we're on the topics of books, how do we all feel about the book excerpts included in Bookshops and Bone Dust? Because there were, you know, the portions that were italicized, and it's like she's reading 10 Links in the Chain, and what was the other one? Heart's Blade was another. There might have been a third, but because I, in writing up some notes for the discussion portion of this episode, I came across some reviews that were like very meh about the little excerpts that were included. And to me, I didn't really feel one way or the other about them, but I don't know, Jonathan, I see like
you. I thought they were meh. I mean, I thought they either had to go a lot more of them or fewer or none. It just didn't do anything for me.
That's interesting.
I didn't feel negatively about them. I do think at some points they lended some stuff to the story. So I guess my feeling towards them is like leaning toward the positive. I don't necessarily think they're completely necessary, but you know, they didn't bother me at all. But there were, I read like three reviews, I think, that were like, I wish this hadn't been part of the story. And I was like, I don't know if I feel that way. That's a lot. Like, that's kind of a,
I don't know. I was fine with them.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, I was fine with them. I don't feel as overly like, oh my God, I super loved them, but I have no negative feelings.
I love fictional media. I love that idea that there is this book or movie or play or something that exists in this world, and I almost always want to know more about it.
And I think that's kind of, that's like the only thing that gives me like a notch in the, this is why I'm kind of, I didn't dislike them, but I can't say they were entirely necessary, because I, maybe that is what it is. And actually maybe feeling like there should have been more means that I like them more than I am actually saying. I don't know. I wasn't against them at all, but I was a little bit like, because when I first read the book, I really don't remember, I didn't have any negative thoughts about their inclusion. At times I felt like it just kind of showed like, here's what got Viv hooked on this book, right? Which is a positive thing. I was surprised that there were so many reviewers who were like, ugh, I wish this hadn't been there.
Yeah, that honestly seems silly to me.
Well, follow-up question. If you were to go to Fern's Blind Book Sale, which of these categories would catch your eye? There's several, so bear with me for a second. Travel, romance, and heartbreak, or adventure, bounties, and bloodshed, family, business, and dwarven politics, knitting, murder, and wine, treason, clockwork, and horticulture, treachery, alchemy, and brotherhood, or last but not least, spicy, moist. And there might have been more to this one, but those are the only words Galena reads aloud. Originally, Fern had suggested passionate and love, and Viv was like, I thought I'd try these instead. So I'm sure there's a third word that goes with spicy and moist, but out of those, well, travel, those romance, and heartbreak, adventure, bounties, and bloodshed, family, business, and dwarven politics, knitting, murder, and wine, treason, clockwork, and horticulture, treachery, alchemy, and brotherhood, and spicy, moist, / passionate love.
Well, these are all such weird combinations to me.
That's the point, though.
So I'd probably go with adventure, bounties, and bloodshed.
Okay, nobody asked for this, but I'm going to do it. depending on the mood I'm in and how much money I have available, all of them except Spicy and Moist, I am not taking a spicy book up to somebody to purchase. Which is not to say I haven't purchased them. I've just done it online where I don't have to face a person with smut in my hand.
Well, it's to be fair, it's not smut in your hand because it's three books wrapped in a brown paper package.
Three books wrapped in a brown paper.
But it does have those words written.
I don't know if you remember this, Tara, but that's how you used to carry your porn magazines out of the porn shop, was in a brown paper bag.
I do remember being in CVS, Walgreens, whatever, and seeing the Playboys and the penthouses and stuff just covered up.
Yeah. All right. So this is what I'm going to have to do. In rough order of interest, some of these are separated by a very narrow margin. I think probably Adventure, Bounties, and Bloodshed, followed closely by Treachery, Alchemy, and Brotherhood, followed closely by Treason, Clockwork, and Horticulture, followed then by Family, Business, and Dwarven Politics, Knitting, Murder, and Wine, and then Travel, Romance, and Heartbreak, I think, in that order. But if I had the money and I were there at that sale, I would have bought all of them.
My first choice would be Travel, Romance, and Heartbreak. It's more about the travel, probably. But I think my second one would be Knitting, Murder, and Wine, only because that is just the most random combination. Like, is somebody murdering somebody with knitting needles? Where does the wine come in? Is it just one book about knitting, one book about murder, and one book about wine? I would like two of those three, and knitting is not one of them. But I feel like the way that they were packaged was like every word would apply to at least two of the books within, is the way I kind of assumed. So I would go with Travel, Romance, and Heartbreak first. Knitting, Murder, and Why would be second, just out of sheer curiosity. And Adventure, Bounties, and Bloodshed is a close third. I don't know what this all says about us.
It's just hard to say. Well, Knitting, Murder, and Wine to me sounds like a Miss Marple. Or an episode of Murder, She Wrote. And it's just like based on the kinds of books I tend to buy. But Treason, Clockwork, and Horticulture sounds like a steampunk version of Alexandre Dumas, The Black Tulip. And I certainly have that book on my shelves. It's like
Family, Business, and Dwarven Politics is obviously The Godfather, right?
Yeah.
Either that or The First Dragon Age. But
I guess that would have been the better question, but I did not have time to think about what I would place in these categories. So that would have been the better question, is like, what would you place in these three?
Treachery, Alchemy, and Brotherhood is Full Metal Alchemist, right? We're good with that. Adventure, Bounties, and Bloodshed.
Well, this isn't a book, it's a game, but I would put Red Dead Redemption. Totally.
Yeah, no.
Well, I was going to say Have Gun, Will Travel or something like that.
Yeah, and Travel, Romance, and Heartbreak. This is a little bit of a deep cut, pun not intended. Lois McMaster Buchholz's The Sharing Knife series, which features travel, romance, and some heartbreak. So
Hold on. Yeah. Family, Business, and Dwarven Politics, The Hobbit.
Where's the business?
He signs a contract.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
He signs a contract, which is he gets a 14th part of all profits, gems and jewels accepted. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that works for me. With a little careful look, I can get the Silmarillion to be travel, romance, and heartbreak.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, I can do it. Yeah. There's a lot of travel. There is some romance and there's a lot of heartbreak. If he goes on a book tour and anybody goes, we have to ask him if he had specific examples in mind.
Yes.
And what those were.
Maybe I'll just like find him on Twitter or something and be like, excuse me, Travis.
Oh, he's on the grant. He's on the grant.
Oh, he is. Oh, yeah. Oh, all right. Well, this is not even last because I do have one last closing question after this. But I just wanted to say, you guys, that epilogue. I love that we get to see Viv with Tandri again, to be honest, especially after, in my opinion, the meh and kind of forced feeling romance in Bookshops and Bone Dust. Also that Fern has been doing well enough, but with Satchel off on his own adventures, also yay Satchel, is now looking to spread her wings a bit and is coming to Thune for a visit and maybe longer than that. It doesn't need to be another book. I want a little novella or like a short story about Fern opening a bookshop next to Legends and Lattes. I do wonder if there is any story left to tell, should Fern open that bookshop next to Legends and Lattes? I don't think it's a full novel necessarily. But
I don't know. I felt there was, because at the end of Legends and Lattes, there's that epilogue where we have that all of a sudden like Wuja fight scene.
With Fenice, yeah.
With Fenice. And I'm like, there was enough there that I'm like, okay, well, I want to know a little bit more about what's going on with all this business. So.
But I mean, I think Venice is gone now. If Travis Baldry comes out with another book, even if it's not Viv, even if it's just like, let's focus on some other character that we know from these books, I am down for it. How about Galena's tale with the roving party that Viv has left? That Ooh. Sort of thing.
Ooh, I know what that one is. It's Daggers and Distilleries.
Oh my God, I love it. Although she does also, she eats a lot too, though.
Daggers, Diners, and Dives.
Oh my God. I love it.
We're going to Flavor Keep, everybody. It's all right.
I would fucking love a Guy Fieri inspired character.
Yeah, I would read that book.
Any last thoughts about the epilogue other than it being super fucking adorable?
No, just it was great because it was super fucking adorable.
Then it brings us back to the story that we had in the first book in a way. So, all right, closing question. Legends and Lattes is about Viv finding her people. Thoughts on Bookshops and Bone Dust then being the story about Viv finding herself?
I like that because one of the things about the parallels that you mentioned is that, oh, wow, a lot of this stuff is really similar to what happened in Bookshop and Bone Dust. It's like, okay, well, here's maybe where Viv got those ideas. Here's a retired fighter managing a bakery. Here's, you know, I think it's Viv, because of her injuries, being forced to see possibilities for herself that she didn't see before. And maybe not immediately. Maybe she's not like, oh, I could do this. But maybe a few years later when she goes into a coffee shop and it clicks for her.
Yeah, for sure. I'm the type of person who I absolutely believe that you have to find yourself before you can find your people. And so I really felt that connection between these two stories. Obviously, Viv still goes out and sows her wild oats, essentially, as anybody should do. And I don't mean that in like a sexual or dirty way. I mean that in a find your own adventure and be your own person. Like find yourself, have your adventures, be your person, and then settle down and you very likely will find your people along the way because Galena is absolutely one of her people. And I think that the other, minus Fenice, the other people, what was it, Tyvus and the other non-Fenice character in her party from Legends and Lattes. So three of the four other people in her party were her people. She just didn't want to have that lifestyle anymore, but they still stayed connected. Then she settles down and finds more of her people. I really do feel whether or not Travis Baldry meant to do this, I do feel like this is a Viv finding herself and that's how she eventually finds her people, whether it's along the way, aka Galena, in a way Tyvus and the other, it was a dwarf. I cannot remember his name for the life of me. And then of course, ending up in Thune and finding Tandri and Thimble and I'm also blanking on like the five other characters she befriends there. But
so you're comparing this first book to her Roosbringer.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know if I would call it that because it wasn't like she was living in an Amish paradise over here.
No, but but it gave her an opportunity to decide.
But that's just
whether she wanted to go. The life that she was basically brought up to be in, because it seemed to me, and maybe I misinterpreted, but she was raised by Rackham, right? I mean, since she was like a teenager. Mm-hmm. I thought it said that she was with him since she was a teenager and that she was being trained by him. That's what I thought I read. And if I'm mistaken.
So I think it's maybe a combination of what you're saying and what I think is that Viv mentions to Galena that she ended up with Rackham because she was suggested to him to be a member of his Ravens by somebody who knew and liked her. She was very young for sure, but also there's some part of me that is like, did she end up in that life because she's an orc? Had she had
of course.
Different, right, but had she been a different creature, like what did I
But yeah, but do you end up in an Amish paradise because you're Amish, right? I mean, it's
like true.
So I see some parallels.
But I totally get what you're saying, and I think it's a little bit of both, honestly. I am going to read one quote, and real quick, if you guys have anything to say about it after I read it, let me know. But Viv is talking to Fern, and she says, "The more I think about it, it seems like it ought to be obvious, but people in books are wrong all the time. Hell, the authors are wrong." So maybe that's what the story says in the words that got put down. But if you could read past the end, the words that didn't get written, maybe it ends up being something else altogether. And Fern replies, the story past the story. And I do think that's kind of, that's what fanfic is, right? Yeah, a lot of the time, the story past the story. Yeah. But also Fern brings that back around when Viv is saying goodbye. And Fern says, like, see you in the story past the story. Then we get the epilogue and it's like, oh,
yep.
They're going to see each other again in the story past the story. I thought that was a very, very clever, honestly.
So are you going to write the fanfic of that meeting?
This doesn't look like I have time to write.
Who's got time?
As we close out the episode, just want to give a shout out to our Heroes Tier patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us. Once again, I'm Tara, along with fellow hosts Jonathan and Seth. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or Blue Sky, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. The next duology we're covering is The Nox Invasions, and that's spelled N-A-H-X, by Gabrielle Prendergast. So look for those episodes in May. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.